Spend your tax return wisely. With Straight Talk Wireless, you can get a Samsung Galaxy A51 for just $199. Plus, get the $45 unlimited talk, text, and data plan with no contract on America's best networks for up to 50% less. That's Straight Talk Wireless. A man was dead, shot in the back of the head. A 16-year-old girl was swiftly arrested and charged as an adult for his death. Without taking the stand in her own defense to tell her side of the story, she was convicted. Her sentence was life in prison with the possibility of parole, although she must serve at least 51 years before being considered for release. That meant the first opportunity for her to possibly see the outside world again would be when she turned 67 years old. In today's episode, we're going to dive into the Cyntoia Brown case. It's a name you might have heard before. A PBS documentary first introduced Cyntoia to the rest of the country, then a Netflix documentary. And then, plenty of attention from celebrities, from Rihanna and Kim Kardashian to LeBron James, who all shared the same message. Hashtag Free Cyntoia. Cyntoia's case raised plenty of issues. How does the criminal justice system treat young people who are convicted of violent crimes? Can teenagers who have undergone childhood trauma be rehabilitated? Legally speaking, is it really the fault of a victim when they kill their abuser? This is Jillian, and in partnership with Law and Crime, you are listening to Court Junkie, episode 149. Take coloring your hair at home to the next level with Madison Reed. Now, you might be wondering how you would find the right color, and then what about the cost? Well, Madison Reed makes coloring your hair at home affordable, and they give you the tools you need to make it easy to choose your perfect color. For just $22, Madison Reed gives you beautiful, professional hair color delivered right to your door. And Madison Reed's color is unique. It's crafted by master colorists who blend nuances of light, dark, cool, and warm tones to create over 55 gorgeous multidimensional shades. To find your perfect shade, you just go to the website, madison-reed.com, and take their quick online quiz that will ask you some simple questions about your hair and your goals. So do your hair coloring at home and look as if you just came from the salon. Now, Court Junkies can get 10% off plus free shipping on their first color kit by using the code COURT. Go to madison-reed.com and use the code COURT. That's madison-reed.com and use the code COURT. Did you know inflammation in the body is the cause of so many issues, from anxiety to insomnia to skin issues and hair thinning? Fittish is a wellness brand that offers affordable and transparent CBD options, ranging from tinctures that help promote a better sense of overall balance to a wide array of skincare that fits into your lifestyle. Fittish CBD has helped hundreds of thousands of individuals dealing with issues, from acne to the most severe cases of dry skin, or who had the desire just to feel better. I started using the Doing It CBD moisturizer on my skin a couple weeks ago, and it's super lightweight, doesn't have any annoying fragrance, and it doesn't feel sticky or gooey. In fact, it makes my skin look more even and fresh, even without makeup. Try Fittish CBD for yourself to get the best wellness in the game at fittish.com and use the code COURT15 for 15% off your order. That's FITISH.com and enter the code COURT15 at checkout for 15% off your order. Fittish, a clear mind and clearer skin for the win. The case against Cyntoia Brown begins at 7:19 p.m. on August 7th, 2004, when a 911 call went out in Nashville, Tennessee. "What's going on over there, ma'am?" the 911 dispatcher asked. "Homicide," the voice replied. And then the phone went dead. The caller hung up. The caller was 16-year-old Cyntoia Brown. Police arrived to what was an obvious crime scene. An adult man, Johnny Allen, was laying naked, face down in a pool of blood on his bed. According to court documents, his hands were beneath his face, his fingers kind of partially interlocked as if he had been sleeping. An autopsy revealed that he had been shot in the back of the head and that he did not have any defensive wounds. He had been dead for at least 12 hours. The evidence wasn't hard to find. A .40 caliber shell casing under the bed, a bullet hole that went through the bedroom wall, and a pillowcase by Johnny's head with gunshot residue. Johnny was 43 years old. He worked as a real estate agent, although he was also known to teach Sunday school at his church and help out as a youth minister, according to media reports. The investigation into his death moved quickly. Within hours, police found Johnny's abandoned white pickup truck in a Walmart parking lot, and they narrowed down a person of interest, Cyntoia. "Police," authorities shouted as they banged on the hotel room door where they knew Cyntoia was staying. She had been living with an older man called Cutthroat, whom she would later say had been abusing her and sex trafficking her. Cyntoia ran out the door, yelling, "Cut had nothing to do with this. I'll tell you all everything." She waived her Miranda rights and spoke to police, telling them what happened. Cyntoia denied having sex with Johnny, who had been a stranger to her. She said she met Johnny around 11 p.m. on August 6th as she walked near a Sonic fast food drive-thru. He picked her up in his truck, bought her food, and offered to let her spend the night at his house. Cyntoia agreed. Back at his home, he showed her some guns, and then he got into bed with her. Cyntoia said Johnny spoke in a whisper and started touching her. He then reached for something under the bed. Cyntoia said she thought he was grabbing for a gun, so she reacted first. She snatched a .40 caliber handgun she kept in her purse and shot him. Before she left Johnny's house, she took $172 in cash from his wallet and two of his guns, and then drove his white Ford F-150 pickup truck to Walmart. Richard Reed, who lived next door to Cyntoia at the extended stay in-town suites, gave her a ride from Walmart back to the hotel. Cyntoia did not try to keep what she did a secret. Richard would later say she told him that she had, quote, "shot somebody in the head for $50,000 and some guns." She then asked Richard for a ride to go back to Johnny's house to help her clean it out. Richard declined. He would later say he didn't take her seriously, that he didn't believe Cyntoia had shot anyone until he saw the news reports on TV. In the eyes of the court, Cyntoia was considered an adult and was transferred out of the juvenile court system. For her 2006 trial, her defense team claimed self-defense. Jurors didn't hear directly from Cyntoia, who did not take the stand. But they learned of her self-defense claims when her statements she had given to police came out. Jurors also didn't learn much about who Cyntoia was and what she had experienced in her upbringing, or the true extent of the mental health struggles she faced. 24-year-old Cutthroat wouldn't be heard from either. In 2005, the man whose real name was Garion McLaughlin had been murdered in an unrelated incident, according to media reports. At the end of her trial, Cyntoia remembered the jurors entering the courtroom before they revealed the verdict. Only one of them made eye contact with her. "I knew right then and there I was getting a life sentence," Cyntoia wrote in her 2019 book, Free Cyntoia, My Search for Redemption in the American Prison System. "I stared at the jury, my chest heaving as I tried to slow my breathing. Whatever you do, don't cry," I thought. I wanted them to feel my anger. Her gut feeling was right. Within moments, the jury's verdict was read. Santoya was convicted of first-degree murder and especially aggravated robbery. She was now 18 years old. But that's not the end of the story by any means. Recovering her case through the lens of hundreds of pages of post-conviction court documents filed over the years as her legal team sought a new trial and tried to overturn her sentence. Karen Franklin, one of the many supporters for Santoya, explained what propelled her Tennessee social workers organization to get involved and to advocate on Santoya's behalf.
She was 16 when this occurred, and that it just a real belief that our system needs to be for that age group, particularly focused on what can we do to rehabilitate or what can we do to support that individual.
When Santoya was born, her mother was 16 years old, a teenager, who steadily drank up to a fifth of liquor or more a day during her pregnancy. Santoya's biological mom, who had been in and out of prison and who battled alcohol and drug addictions, raised Santoya off and on until she was two. Then she gave her up for adoption. It was clear that there was turmoil in Santoya's early life, although court records don't provide a more detailed account into the exact circumstances. What was clear, many experts believe Santoya's biological mother's drinking caused damage to her unborn child. In court documents, Dr. Richard Adler said that alcohol is a heinous poison to a fetus and affects each and every cell. Dr. Adler, a clinical and forensic psychologist from Seattle, Washington, said the primary disability in fetal alcohol syndrome is damage to the baby's brain. Then, as a person with fetal alcohol syndrome grows up, they also experience, quote, secondary disabilities, such as having trouble with school, behavior, obtaining employment, and the law. According to the CDC, fetal alcohol syndrome disorder happens when a mother drinks alcohol during her pregnancy, passing it through the umbilical cord to her unborn baby. The result can be a litany of symptoms, some mild, some severe, that can include hyperactive behavior, poor memory, vision and hearing problems, learning disabilities, speech and language delays, and bad reasoning or judgment skills. In the court documents, Santoya's defense team goes on to say that you could see the physical consequences of fetal alcohol syndrome in Santoya's appearance. By the way, the area between the bottom of her nose and the top of her upper lip was significantly flattened, or how some of her fingers were curved. There were also invisible effects, too, that they said emerged in Santoya's behavior, especially as she got older. She was impulsive. She fidgeted and couldn't keep still. She was easily distracted. Her understanding and reasoning, her problem-solving skills and her motor coordination all had shortcomings. Her adaptive functioning was years behind what it should have been. She struggled to understand visual cues, like reading someone's physical expressions. In fifth grade, her schoolwork struggled. She acted out. At age 12, she broke into a home with other girls and stole jewelry. Her court cases in juvenile court began stacking up. In high school, she got into fights. She threw a chair across the room and wasn't afraid of fighting her fellow teenagers or adults. It didn't matter who. She was described as manipulative and defiant, refusing to do something if she didn't want to. Those who met Santoya through the juvenile court system said she was cold and distant, nonchalant. But Santoya was also incredibly smart. Her IQ tested high. She was brilliant, her defense attorney would later say. She was considered gifted in high school. Other experts agreed. Dr. Paul Connor, a clinical psychologist specializing in neuropsychology, wrote, quote, "She has an IQ that is in the 130s. She is extremely bright from that perspective, but her ability to apply that appropriately independently on a day-to-day basis in the real world is profoundly impaired." A teenager's brain is still developing anyway. Another expert said, quote, "That's why they might do something that seems irrational sometimes, because their brains and their executive functions aren't as developed as they will be in their 20s. The expert went on, "For children born with fetal alcohol syndrome, the developmental process is even more delayed because of their brain impairment. Centoya's self-control, memory, and thinking would not mature until she was in her early 30s. A brain map for Centoya revealed, quote, "blue areas, areas of damage, in the frontal lobe of Centoya's brain. Other areas of damage extended beyond the frontal lobe." Dr. Connor said, "When Centoya was 23 years old, her adaptive functioning was that of a 13 to 14-year-old, and her adaptive functioning skills were at the level of a mentally retarded individual." But Centoya seemed to have been encouraging herself to overcome all the challenges she had faced so far in life. In the hotel, Nashville police discovered Centoya's 3-page handwritten note that appeared to be written as a motivational journal entry to herself. One passage read, quote, "Show no weaknesses. Fuck what happens in this world. It's constantly changing. If you stay stuck on a focal point in your life, you'll fall behind the population. Remain at least 5 steps ahead of those who surround you. Never stray from your motive. It's all about making it. If at first you don't succeed, invent new approaches, move on from there. No time to waste backtracking." One reason why I love podcasts is because I love the actual audio medium. I don't often have time to sit down and read a good book, but I can listen to something while going through my everyday life. And that's also why I love Audible. With Audible, you can find the largest selection of audiobooks, from the buzziest new releases to bestsellers. But did you know they also have original entertainment too? From celebrity creators to even popular and binge-worthy podcasts. One of the last titles I listened to from Audible was Catch and Kill, which was all about the uncovering of the Harvey Weinstein case. It was a fascinating listen, and also enraging to hear about everything the victims in the case went through as they opened up and told their stories. As an Audible member, you get 1 credit every month, good for any title in their entire premium collection. And that is yours to forever keep in your Audible library. You can download titles and listen offline anytime and anywhere. And the best part is that new members can always try Audible for 30 days for free. To get started, visit audible.com/courtjunkie or text courtjunkie to 500-500. That's audible.com/courtjunkie or text courtjunkie to 500-500. It's time for some straight talk. Let's face it, tax returns could look a little different for a lot of people this year, but you're still going to get a lot of noise in your ear about how you should spend it. So when the big carriers start trying to get you to splurge on that latest nonsense, just tune it out and only go with the best deals. Spend it on what makes you happy. With Straight Talk Wireless, you can get a Samsung Galaxy A51 for just $199, so you can listen to your favorite music wherever you go. Plus, get the $45 unlimited talk, text, and data plan with no contract on America's best networks for up to 50% less. Come on, start the year on a high note. Tune out the nonsense and tune in to Straight Talk Wireless. Straight Talk Wireless. No contract, no compromise. Centoya, who was raised by her maternal grandmother, eventually ran away from her adopted home and began crashing with different people in Nashville. She was using drugs and alcohol. In July 2004, she met 24-year-old Cutthroat, who seemed nice in the beginning. In her book, it's clear the younger girl developed a crush on this older man, who she said listened to her and paid attention to her. That, too, did not last. Cutthroat convinced her to use cocaine. So Santoya started using and living in a hotel with him. Again, she was just 16. He was 24. According to court documents, Santoya reported he was violent to her, that he almost killed her one time by choking her, and that she was scared of him. He called her demeaning names and began sex trafficking her, demanding she give him whatever cash she made. Santoya wrote about this in her book. Quote, Cut promptly took the envelope from me with a smile. He always smiled when I gave him the money. I'm not sure of the precise moment where I stopped feeling like I was a prostitute, the moment where I accepted that as my reality. Even as I approached cars with rolled down windows and negotiated prices, I told myself it was only temporary. Santoya said she felt numb. She went into survival mode. On the day of the shooting, Santoya said she was probably high. That's all I ever did, she said. She left the hotel, left Cutthroat, and started walking towards Sonic when Johnny stopped in his truck and asked if she needed a ride or wanted some food. Santoya told police that Johnny assured her he was a good guy. She shouldn't be staying on the streets, he told her. Santoya thought he looked old, maybe 50. Johnny asked her if she was up for any action. They began negotiating a rate for sex. Santoya asked for $200. Johnny suggested $100. They settled on $150. In the car, Santoya opened up about her family. Johnny told her about his past. He had been in the military. He was a sharp shooter and could shoot the eye out of a pissant, he told her. They drove to Johnny's house and he invited her in. He offered her some wine and tried to kiss her, but she pushed him away. The conversation about guns continued. Johnny kept talking about them. He showed her one from his collection. He then let her use his shower. Based on court documents, here's what Santoya said she would have testified to if she had taken the stand at her trial. When Santoya got out of the shower, Johnny was lying on the bed and was naked except for shiny gold disco ball-like boxers. Santoya kept her clothes on. Together, they went downstairs to watch TV. What did Santoya make of Johnny? He was weird, she said. She was aware of the gun cabinet in the room, so she stayed put. Johnny told her he wanted to make love to her and that he loved her. They went back to his bedroom and Santoya asked if she could take a nap. She took off her skirt and pretended to go to sleep. But Johnny kept touching her, kept getting in and out of bed. Santoya felt panicked. She wasn't sure what he was doing. The whole night seemed odd. According to court documents, Santoya described those quick, instinctive moments before she shot him. She said that the victim got back into the bed, that he grabbed her really hard, and that she thought he had figured out she was faking to be asleep. She said that she saw him roll over, maybe to try to reach for something, that she thought he was going to get a gun or is going to do something to her, and that she just reacted. Santoya, who was lying on her stomach, kind of raised up, reached over to the nightstand on her side of the bed, took a gun out of her purse, and fired the gun one time. She said that Cut had given her the gun to protect herself and that she had never fired it before she shot the victim. Santoya claimed she didn't know he was dead. As she ran out, the following thought crossed her mind. She would be returning to Cutthroat, empty-handed. She stole some of Johnny's guns and took his cash. She then drove Johnny's truck to the hotel, where she found Cut and admitted that she had shot someone. Cut instructed her to dump the truck at the Walmart parking lot. The next day, Santoya called 911 from Johnny's cell phone. Within hours, she was in police custody. After her police interview, she was allowed to make two phone calls. A detective heard her tell the person on the other line that she had been charged with murder and homicide. Quote, "I don't know exactly which words she used, but she was giggling and laughing at the same time," the detective said. Centoya lied to detectives and gave them the wrong birthday, so they thought at first that she was 18. When they realized the error, Centoya was taken to juvenile court for booking. She asked Detective Derry Baltimore for paper to write a message. She wrote, "I am not guilty. The reason what happened is sketchy is because I am in fear. I know it's my story against theirs, and too much is pointing at me. What I need is reassurance from a lawyer in order to ensure my protection. I didn't commit this crime. I don't have the heart to." Centoya called her adoptive mother from jail and said, "I killed somebody. I executed him." Her grandmother, Elinette Washington, didn't interpret Centoya's words as a confession. It was more an expression of helplessness. About a week after the shooting, Centoya was held at the Western Mental Health Institute and began violently acting out. She asked a nurse if she could use the telephone. When the nurse told her no, Centoya grabbed her by the hair and the face. According to the nurse's testimony, Centoya said, "I'm going to do you like I did him, but I'm not going to shoot you once in the back of the head. I'm going to shoot you three times and listen while your blood splatters on the wall." It took nearly five adults to restrain and hold back Centoya, who left bruises and cuts on the nurse. Centoya reportedly opened up to two other women who were inmates with her in jail a few months later. Inmate Shayla Bryant, who was awaiting her own first-degree murder trial, testified that Centoya told her in November 2004 that, quote, "This guy that she was talking to used to send her out to prostitute, and she was mad at him. And the man tried to rape her, so she shot him." The whole motive seemed too perfect to be true, Shayla thought. What a convenient version of events. She was also suspicious of Centoya's delivery when she recounted what happened. She said Centoya couldn't keep a straight face and started laughing. Shayla described Centoya as jolly as she wanted to be while discussing Johnny's death. It didn't look like she had any remorse. She didn't cry. She was just there. Shayla testified against Centoya during the trial, but Shayla's motives for speaking out were also brought up during cross-examination. Shayla agreed that the first words out of her mouth to Detective Charles Robinson were something to the effect of, "Well, what the hell are you going to do for me?" She also agreed that the bond in her murder case had been reduced from $50,000 to $5,000 after she spoke to detectives. The testimony of Centoya's lighthearted behavior, laughing at the murder charges and almost gleeful she had killed a human being, seemed to be a damning portrayal. But Centoya's friend, Shakoha Armstrong, the person who had been on the receiving end of one of Centoya's phone calls after the police interview, said Centoya usually laughed when she talked about tragic circumstances. Centoya initially laughed when she confided in her friend that she had been raped. But soon the smile was gone, the coping mechanism broken through, and Centoya began to cry. Centoya shared with Shakoha that her boyfriend, Cutthroat, made her leave with other men. Shakoha interpreted that to mean that Cutthroat was sex trafficking Centoya. During the trial, prosecutors called into evidence some of the crime scene photos of Johnny's corpse. The full impact of what I had done sank in as I took in the graphic, bloody pictures, wishing I could look away but unable to do so, Centoya wrote in her book. This man was gone. He had parents, a family who had loved him. He didn't get a chance to change his ways. If I hadn't shot him that night, what kind of life could he have had? As the prosecution rested its case in Santoya's trial, her defense called two witnesses that were meant to cast doubts on Johnny's clean-cut, church-going realtor image. Galena Osborne worked at Sonic and remembered serving Johnny and Santoya that night in the truck. Johnny left an impression because she reminded him to put on his headlights earlier. Galena testified she joked that their meal at the cheap hamburger joint was $99 when she served them. "That's really expensive," Johnny had said. "But she's worth it," Galena joked. "I don't know, we'll see," Johnny said back. Galena thought Johnny might have been flirting with her. Her first impression of the pair was that Johnny seemed cocky and Santoya seemed comfortable in his presence. She assumed the 43-year-old man driving around the 16-year-old girl were either related or family friends. Sandra Liggett was also called to the stand to testify about Johnny's character after they met in a restaurant in February 2004, a few months before his death. She said she began attending Johnny's church, and they emailed and called each other a bit. They were supposed to go on a date to the movies in March 2004. Instead of taking her to the movies, though, Johnny wanted to show off his house. He seemed nice, and he was a realtor after all, so it seemed to make sense. Sandra agreed. Sandra described what happened next. Johnny showed her several rooms in his house before leading her into his bedroom. He told her that he wanted to get something out of the way first. Then he kissed her. Sandra told Johnny, "This is wrong. I don't want to do this." Johnny gave Sandra a hard stare, which she described as scary. She asked Johnny to bring her to her car, at which point Johnny kissed her again and began pulling off Sandra's clothes. Eventually, Johnny and Sandra had sexual intercourse. Although she did not welcome Johnny's advances, Sandra just decided that it was best to do it because she was too scared to fight him. Sandra never reported the incident to the police because she said no one would believe her. She testified that Johnny hadn't threatened her, showed her a weapon, or held her down. She also acknowledged that she had not wanted to publicly tell this story during Santoya's trial, preferring to deal with the incident quietly on her own terms. But she agreed to testify after she had been subpoenaed. Jessica Snyder, a 17-year-old waitress, was not allowed to testify before the jury, so the jurors never got to hear her recount how Johnny hit on her, telling her how gorgeous she was and giving her his phone number. Jessica and the other waitress felt creeped out by him, their regular customer who often hit on them and asked them out. After the 2006 criminal trial, the state court denied Santoya's request to appeal, so instead she filed a pro se petition for post-conviction relief. In it, she argued she had been denied effective legal counsel. She also stated that there was new evidence to present, showing that fetal alcohol syndrome played a part in her actions on the night in question. She believed her life sentence was unconstitutional. Richard McGee and Wendy Tucker Jones had represented Santoya during her trial. Wendy described the defense's behind-the-scenes discussions as they prepared for trial and considered whether Santoya should testify or not. Santoya and her family wanted her to testify, but her co-counsel had reservations. According to court documents, quote, "On cross-examination, co-counsel acknowledged that Santoya's story about the shooting was compelling, consistent, and believable. However, co-counsel was concerned that if Santoya testified, she could open the door to some lines of inquiry by the state." Listening back to tapes of Santoya's transfer hearing in juvenile court, "There were parts that were worrisome for us if they came out at trial," Wendy said, according to a court filing from the Court of Criminal Appeals of Tennessee. What if Santoya said something contradictory at her trial from her previous statements made during her juvenile transfer hearing and to the police? Wendy didn't want the state to impeach her on cross-examination. It was one thing to be consistent when Santoya practiced testifying with her attorneys, but how would she do under oath and under stress during a trial? A few details had changed over time, like the timing of when she took a shower at Johnny's home. In one version, she said it was before the shooting. In another version, it was after. And Santoya had initially lied about where she had gotten the gun, something she said she did to protect Cut. But according to the post-conviction petition, some of those concerns were unfounded. Santoya's legal team had incorrectly told her that her testimony, made during that juvenile transfer hearing, could be used against her during the murder trial. In reality, the jury would not be allowed to hear anything Santoya said during that hearing. Still, there were other reasons why Santoya's attorneys didn't want her to testify. Wendy also had fears of how Santoya would come across on the stand. Would she stay calm? She already had problems during the juvenile transfer hearing. Santoya seemed prone to outbursts just talking to her own attorneys, let alone how would she do being cross-examined by a potentially combative prosecutor. Quote, counsel was worried that Santoya would lose her temper on cross-examination because Santoya had lost her temper in meetings with trial counsel, had lost her temper with guards, and had an inability at times to control her emotions. Wendy, a criminal attorney who had around 60 cases under her belt, said she had conversations with Santoya about whether she should take the stand. Ultimately, Santoya took her attorney's advice not to do it. As her team prepared for her trial, her attorneys looked at her mental health. Could they use that as part of their defense? In juvenile court, Santoya had a mental health evaluation at age 12 and then was re-evaluated again before being tried as an adult for Johnny's murder. Wendy said, I know we had to make sure she was competent, so we certainly did an evaluation for competence. I'm not sure if we went any further at that point on any other mental health issues. They received three boxes full of her psychological and medical records. Santoya's defense reviewed the material. Santoya had been diagnosed with other mental health disorders previously, but nothing related to her biological mother's drinking during her pregnancy. For instance, as a child, Santoya had a mental health episode and, quote, appeared to be completely out of touch with reality. In the year 2000, doctors had questioned whether Santoya had bipolar disorder with psychotic features or some other unknown condition. In 2002, Santoya was tested and was showing dissociation, which means she was disconnected from her thoughts, feelings, memories, and surroundings. It was a, quote, rare and worrisome psychiatric symptom, according to court documents. When it came to fetal alcohol syndrome, however, that was never brought up as Santoya's attorneys prepared for her trial and plotted her defense. Dr. William Burnett, a forensic psychiatrist from Vanderbilt University who re-examined Santoya, never mentioned the possibility of fetal alcohol syndrome disorder affecting Santoya either, Wendy said. After reviewing the case, Dr. Burnett diagnosed Santoya with borderline personality disorder. He said, quote, borderline personality disorder is a mental condition that affects on an ongoing basis and on a pervasive basis how a person thinks about reality and how a person relates to other people. Individuals who have this condition have very unstable, very intense, but unstable relationships with other people, meaning they go from one extreme to the other. The disorder made sense in the way that Santoya seemed to brag about the killing. It also fit because Santoya did not knowingly or intelligently waive her Miranda rights when she spoke to the police, he said. She wouldn't have truly understood the concept. Ultimately, Santoya's defense decided against bringing up any of her mental health issues during their arguments at trial. Unless you have some sort of objective evidence to go with it, such as a brain scan that showed damage or something, Juries seem hesitant to really give a lot of weight to psychological testimony, Wendy said. They didn't want the forensic psychiatrist to bring up the bad things about Santoya. According to court documents, if he had been called as a witness at trial, Dr. Burnett was expected to have told the jury about Santoya's mental health issues, which was favorable to the defense. Quote, however, Dr. Burnett was aware of information that also painted her in a very negative light. This included her negative behavior in custody, her prior record, and her drug use. When it came to Santoya's personality, her defense attorney called her brilliant. But there was something different about her. Her defense attorney couldn't pinpoint what it was. Her personality was all over the place, and you didn't know who you were going to be talking to from time to time. But it wasn't competency issues. It was more like there was something wrong that we couldn't figure out what it was, Wendy said. She never made the connection with Santoya, her brain damage, and fetal alcohol syndrome. That never crossed my radar, Wendy said. In fact, no one mentioned fetal alcohol syndrome until after the trial was over, and Wendy got a telephone call from director Dan Berman. Berman was making a PBS documentary on Santoya's case, and later a feature on Santoya for Netflix. He suggested that fetal alcohol syndrome may have played a part in the crime. Wendy said the entire time she had represented Santoya, something seemed off. When Berman called her, and when she saw what another doctor had said about fetal alcohol syndrome, it then all made sense to her. Wendy's co-counsel, Richard McGee, acknowledged that part of their defense strategy could have been to call an expert in fetal alcohol syndrome to offer testimony that Santoya didn't know what she was doing when she murdered Johnny. He wrote in court documents that presenting mental health testimony of some type of organic brain damage can be very persuasive with a jury, more so than someone who had a rough childhood and as a result has a personality disorder. For Santoya, the discussion into what was wrong with her was difficult to take in. She wrote in her book, quote, "The overwhelming consensus among the world was that something must be wrong with me. I was damaged, defective, broken beyond repair. Every mistake I had ever made was now rolled out as more evidence that I was incorrigible, one big screw-up. By the end of the trial, I felt like I was basically Satan's seed. The only question was whether I could be fixed or if there was nothing left for me but to be thrown away in prison." While in prison, Santoya never stopped fighting for her freedom. It seemed like an uphill battle, since her new legal team kept getting dealt significant legal defeats, one after another, over the years. In 2012, her attorneys unsuccessfully sought a new trial so they could present new evidence about fetal alcohol syndrome. They appealed to the Court of Criminal Appeals of Tennessee, after the Davidson County Criminal Court denied her petition for post-conviction relief. Santoya's team argued her criminal trial attorneys were ineffective for encouraging her not to testify, for not interviewing or investigating her biological mother, and for failing to bring up her mental health issues in her defense. They wrote that had she testified, her testimony would have been compelling and believable, and that it was the only way she could have shown the jury her abusive domination by Cutthroat and Johnny's dark side. In 2014, a judge again ruled against Santoya, reaffirming the post-conviction court's ruling. Judge Norma McGee Ogle argued that the post-conviction court found Santoya's trial attorneys thoroughly investigated her case and pointed out that her attorneys had brought in Dr. Burnett to learn more about her mental health issues. Considering fetal alcohol syndrome and its effects were also incredibly complex, the judge wrote, Dr. Adler had indicated that diagnosing a child with it was difficult, and that Dr. Brown had said Cyntoia had been diagnosed with many disorders. She also agreed with the state that Cyntoia hadn't shown she was actually innocent. But starting in 2017, something started happening. Momentum was building. Celebrities began retweeting Cyntoia's story, and her case soon went viral. "The system has failed," Kim Kardashian wrote on Twitter. "It's heartbreaking to see a young girl sex trafficked. Then, when she has the courage to fight back, is jailed for life. We have to do better and do what's right. I've called my attorneys yesterday to see what can be done to fix this. Hashtag free Cyntoia Brown." Rihanna wrote, quote, "Imagine at the age of 16 being sex trafficked by a pimp named Cutthroat. After days of being repeatedly drugged and raped by different men, you were purchased by a 43-year-old child predator who took you to his home to use you for sex. You end up finding enough courage to fight back and shoot and kill him." In May 2018, the Tennessean newspaper reported that the State Board of Parole had rendered a divided vote on making a recommendation on Cyntoia's fate. According to the newspaper, two board members voted to recommend Tennessee Governor Bill Haslam grant clemency, which would free Cyntoia from prison. Two others voted for the governor to deny her clemency bid, so Cyntoia would keep serving her life sentence. And two others supported the governor reducing her sentence so she could be released after 25 years. That summer, Governor Haslam received the parole board's report, which was thousands of pages long. Meanwhile, lawmakers, criminal justice advocates, and celebrities kept pushing for Cyntoia's release. The movement had grown. One of those advocates was the National Association of Social Workers. It was an unusual step for the association's Tennessee chapter to advocate for an individual case, according to the chapter's executive director, Karen Franklin. The organization sent a letter to Governor Haslam in support of him granting clemency for Cyntoia.
It's pretty unique for us on individual cases, actually, that we will often, you know, we'll communicate with the governor about policy issues, but it's rare for us to actually send a letter on a particular case. It's a big deal for us to do it, and this was a particularly important case, we felt. Our then-governor, Bill Haslam, took a few years before, had really led a major statewide initiative about the importance of addressing adverse childhood experiences within our state, and really recognizing that we needed to shift the conversation at a state level from looking at what's wrong with you to talking about what happened in your life. And he really, again, Governor Haslam really took and made that a major state focus. So when we contacted the governor's office, we simply encouraged him to utilize the knowledge he had about the impact of adverse childhood experiences as he looked at this case and to grant clemency from that direction. So we talked really more in terms of how to tie it in terms of urging him to grant clemency. We thought he would understand why that was important, particularly in this case where where someone had been abused and was sentenced at age 16.
At the start of 2019, Governor Haslam announced he had reached a decision. He was granting clemency and commuting Cyntoia's original sentence to 15 years, which meant Cyntoia would be released in just a few months. In a statement, he said, quote, "Cyntoia Brown committed, by her own admission, a horrific crime at the age of 16, yet imposing a life sentence on a juvenile that would require her to serve at least 51 years before even being eligible for parole consideration is too harsh, especially in light of the extraordinary steps Ms. Brown has taken to rebuild her life. And it was true. Centoya Brown was not the same person who had entered prison in 2006. She was on the verge of completing her bachelor's degree. She developed a reputation as a mentor for other inmates and became a spiritual person strong in her faith. She also fell in love with a musician and businessman who had watched her documentary and then started writing her letters. Her prison sentence hadn't been a life sentence. In fact, it had saved her life, Centoya said. Those 12 years in prison hadn't just turned me into a woman. They transformed me, Centoya wrote in her book. The girl who desperately wanted to belong, who felt powerless, who clawed and scratched her way out of every corner she was backed into, was gone. On the day her clemency was announced, her attorneys and some of her advocates held a press conference, which was streamed by the Tennessean newspaper. The mood was joyful.
I am honored and privileged today to speak the words of Centoya Brown directly, and these were written by her this morning. Thank you, Governor Haslam, for your act of mercy in giving me a second chance. I will do everything I can to justify your faith in me. I have one course left to finish my bachelor's degree, which I will complete in May 2019. I am thankful for all the support, prayers, and encouragement I have received. We truly serve a God of second chances and new beginnings. The Lord has held my hand this whole time, and I would have never made it without him. Let today be a testament to his saving grace. Thank you to my family for being a backbone these past 14 years. I'm thankful to my lawyers and their staff and all the others who, for the last decade, have freely given of their time and expertise to help me get to this day. I love all of you and will be forever grateful. With God's help, I'm committed to live the rest of my life helping others, especially young people. My hope is to help other young girls avoid ending up where I have been. Thank you.
After spending almost half of her life behind bars, a now 31-year-old Centoya Brown Long reemerged back into the world in August 2019. Centoya, now a married woman, a published author, and an outspoken criminal justice advocate, is on parole for the next 10 years. She wrote this in her book. Up until this point, I've been captive to so many unfilling roles. Outcast Centoya, delinquent Centoya, convict Centoya, heathen Centoya. Now I am exactly who and what the Lord called me to be, free Centoya. There is hope, hope for everyone locked in prisons, physical or spiritual, hope for everyone who doubts they will ever be free. No matter how far you may have fallen, that hope is still there for all who dare to believe their best days are not behind them. And that's all for this episode. As always, I'd love to know what you think about this case. Let me know by joining the conversation on Instagram at Court Junkie, by tweeting me at Court Junkie Pod, or by emailing me at podcast@courtjunkie.com. Today's episode was researched and written by Gabrielle Rousson. If you'd like to hear these episodes ad-free and check out additional bonus content, head on over to courtjunkie.com/support, which will redirect you to my Patreon page. And lastly, please subscribe to my YouTube channel, where I've been releasing some behind-the-scenes videos along with videos of my sidebar episodes, which is a monthly podcast I'm recording with a friend of mine, where we discuss Court Junkie cases as well as other true crime news. So be sure to subscribe at youtube.com/courtjunkie. Thanks again for listening. Until next time. Don't sleep on the Jordan Harbinger Show. It's a podcast you really should be listening to, and I'm not kidding when I say that Court Junkies will especially love it. Jordan's show, which Apple named one of its best of 2018, is aimed at making you a better informed, more critical thinker, so you can get a sense of how the world actually works and come to your own conclusions about what's happening, even inside your own brain. Each episode is a conversation with a different, fascinating guest, and there is something for everyone here. In one episode, for example, Jordan talks to a hostage negotiator from the FBI who offers techniques on how to get people to like and trust you. Another episode tells the story of a cinematographer who discovered a lost city in the jungle and made one of the most important archaeological finds of the century. One of his more recent episodes was with Bruce Sackman, a renowned investigator who tracks down serial killers. Another was with Thomas Erickson, a behavioral expert who talks about how to identify psychopaths. I really enjoy this show, and I think you will as well. Search for The Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R-B as in boy, I-N as in Nancy, G-E-R, on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.